Again, my name is Bill. The show is called Common Ground, every Monday, 10 a.m. until 1 p.m. right here, WHFR Radio 89.3 on the FM dial, the only station making waves.
If you want to change the world, then you have to change yourself. One of the best places in the Metro Detroit area to improve your life is Henry Ford Community College. Henry Ford Community College offers dozens of degree and certificate programs, plus the opportunity to network with your peers and potential employers. Taking classes at Henry Ford Community College gives you the freedom to take your own career path and opens up an infinite number of career possibilities. Additionally, day and evening classes allow you the flexibility of building a schedule tailored to your busy lifestyle. So change the world, change yourself at Henry Ford Community College. For more information on admittance and financial aid and class schedules, call the Henry Ford Community College toll-free number at 1-800-585-HFCC. Again, that's 1-800-585-HFCC.
This is Allison Brown, and you're listening to WHFR Dearborn, broadcasting the best in acoustic music since 1985.
Disclaimer. This show is a WHFR talk show presentation. The opinions expressed by WHFR staff and our guests are not necessarily those of anyone here at Henry Ford Community College, not faculty, staff, administrators, anyone on our Board of Trustees, or students.
Thank you for listening to Philosophy Talk's free weekly download.
You can do your part for intelligent, reflective media by making a tax-deductible contribution to Philosophy Talk.
And we really do rely on your support. Any contribution, big or small, will help us stay on the air and online.
And donating is really very simple. Just visit our website at philosophytalk.org and click on the Donate link.
Thank you for supporting Philosophy Talk, and
thank you for thinking.
This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Today, we're recording the program in front of a live audience at the 69th Annual Conference of the American Humanist Association in San Jose, California.
Our thinking originates at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
Welcome, everyone, to Philosophy Talk.
Our topic today, humanism.
Humanism, John, that's a great topic, but you know, we usually try to have topics that have some controversy about them. Well, what could be controversial about humanism? I mean, humanism is that glorious movement in thought that began in the Renaissance with the rediscovery and reappreciation of the text and arts of the Greeks and Romans. It said human life in this world moves to the center of attention while God, heaven, and the angels and all that stuff, the focus of medieval thought, moves aside. Humanism led to the Enlightenment, to Locke and Hume and Kant, to democracy, to science and progress. Three cheers for humanism.
Well, as you describe it, humanism doesn't seem very controversial, Ken. For one thing, it doesn't seem opposed to religion in general or Christianity in particular. As long as a religion pays suitable attention to humans. I mean, Michelangelo painted the Sistine Chapel, Leonardo da Vinci painted the Last Supper, Locke wrote a book about the reasonableness of Christianity. So a lot of Renaissance and Enlightenment humanists seem to have been Christians. But then why are religious types and fundamentalist Christians in particular so upset these days about humanism, calling humanism a plot to take over our schools, introduce relativism into morals, and all sorts of evil things?
Because they're thinking of secular humanism, John.
Secular humanism. Is secular humanism an alternative to humanism or a species of it or what, Ken?
Well, secular humanism, or it's sometimes called scientific humanism, it's a species of humanism in a more general sense. I mean, there used to be a robust tradition in this country of what's called religious humanism. But many people see secular humanism as the sort of natural development of the ideas implicit in all forms of humanism, including even religious humanism. Because secular humanism doesn't just move the focus and intention from God and heaven and angels to humans. It drops God and heaven and angels and all that stuff from the picture altogether. It doesn't just appreciate science. It takes the reality that science discloses to be all the reality there is. No transcendent truth, no supernatural anything.
Well, you make secular humanism sound like a philosophical doctrine. I mean, it sounds a lot like the naturalist movement in American philosophy in the early 20th century.
Well, you know, that's no accident, because think of one of the people who was instrumental in drawing up the Humanist Manifesto, the first version in 1933, was our very own John Dewey, one of America's great philosophers. So it is a pretty philosophical movement. Here's a rough sketch of some of the things it said in that first manifesto. The universe was not created by anyone. Humans are part of the natural world. Mind and body dualism is to be rejected. There are no supernatural or cosmic guarantees of human values. The end or purpose of human life is the here and now, not some afterlife, and a whole lot more besides that.
So, Ken, these humanists spread out in the audience before us, are these just old-fashioned humans are sort of important and the Greeks and Romans are cool kind of humanists, or are these secular humanists?
Well, John, this is the American Humanist Association. They are direct descendants from John Dewey and his buddies. You can find Manifesto 1 on their website, and you can also find Manifesto 2 and 3. So I think we're definitely in the presence of card-carrying, secular, scientific, God-not-fearing, capital H humanists.
Well, oh my goodness, Ken, what have we gotten ourselves into? I mean, according to Glenn Beck and Sarah Palin and Bill O'Reilly and quite possibly the Pope, too, these people are bound and determined to undermine the moral basis of America. Subvert values, educate a generation of atheists, enlarge the scope of public radio, for all I know, and God knows what else, or maybe I shouldn't say God knows what else.
But you know what, John? We don't need Glenn Beck. We don't need Sarah Palin or Bill O'Reilly. We don't need the Pope, and we don't even need God to tell us what the American Humanist Movement is about, because our guest today is one of their intellectual leaders, the card-carrying secular humanist Jennifer Bardi, editor of the Humanist Magazine. She'll join us in a little bit.
And we'll want our live audience here in San Jose to join in the conversation, too.
But first, our roving philosophical reporter, Rena Palta, files this report.
What exactly is a humanist? A humanist conference is a good place to find out. A place where they play something called Blasphemy Jeopardy.
This longtime fundamentalist leader, you know, after only 3 weeks of counseling, was completely cured of his homosexuality. And, you know, the answer is, you know, who's Ted Haggard?
August Brunsman is executive director of the Secular Student Alliance, based in Columbus, Ohio.
I was the only male undergraduate in Ohio State history that could not care less about football.
So, hating football isn't what makes people humanists, even if Brunsman says a lot of them do. For an answer to the question, what makes a humanist, I went to Bill Nye. Yes, the science guy, and the association's Humanist of the Year.
For me, humanism is, existence is pretty much all you get. And if it's not, what would you do differently? Not too much, for me.
That is, being a good person without believing in God.
The world is much more sensible without supernatural explanations. The pursuit of truth is much more interesting than assuming things that are not provable, or more accurately, ignoring this process that we've found for discovering the nature of nature. Ignoring that is just unsatisfactory.
But why does simply trying to behave like a good person require a label? I took that question to the convention floor.
We like to identify things, including ourselves. Some people say, well, I'm a Catholic. Some people say I'm a Lutheran. Some people say I'm an evolutionist. Some people say creationist. Some people say they're black. Some people say they're white. We're always looking for labels. The brain works on labeling things, including ourselves.
So you're kind of a humanist evangelist.
I guess I'm happy to live and let live if they're happy to live and let live.
I mean, I don't think it's a core value within humanism. I think people are people. And wherever you go, you're going to find people that want to convert you, whatever it is. But it's not a core value.
If not for strategizing on how to spread humanism, then why have a conference at all?
Because everybody here shares something, and when you share a philosophy, when you share ideas, when you share a task, whatever it is, you develop a language that's an insider's language. And you're comfortable expressing your ideas. You're not concerned about how you'll be seen in another world or whether you fit in. In this setting, we all fit in, and we're all accepted as part of our humanist world.
So back to the original question, what makes a humanist? This particular group is mostly secular and focused on bettering the world. But like people who gather around their religious beliefs, these humanists want community. So the conference here ended up being something like a church for secularists. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Rena Palta.
I'm John Perry, along with Ken Taylor. You're listening to Philosophy Talk, coming to you from the American Humanist Association Conference in San Jose, California.
And we're joined now by Jennifer Bardi, editor of the Humanist magazine. Jennifer, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here.
So, Jennifer, were you raised as a humanist, or was there some important conversion in your life or non-conversion experience?
Well, I refer to myself as a professional humanist because I answered an ad in the Washington Post for an editor. But before that, actually, I had identified myself as a humanist mainly in conversation with my sister, who had discovered Christianity well into her 20s.
Oh. I
guess I was raised, my father was kind of a naturalist, and our church, I would say, was where the Sierra Nevada Mountains here in California.
Ah, so you were a humanist from the time you were self-aware, really?
I'd say so.
So you were kind of a... It was your sister that was converted to Christianity, and that kind of brought out
in
conversations what you believed.
She was struggling with this conversion. It was not an easy one for her. So we spent a lot of time talking, and so I would find myself sort of in counterpoint calling myself a humanist.
So Ken, when we were discussing it a bit earlier, he summarized a lot of the first version of the Humanist Manifesto, which was back in 1933, before World War II, maybe when the world was a little more optimistic place, I don't know. There have been two further editions of the manifesto. So bring us up to date. What is a proper humanist committed to according to the current conception? Do you have to be an atheist? Do you have to be a moral relativist? Do you have to be a scoundrel out to subvert the American value system?
No to number three. I would like to say I think that atheism and humanism have become, the distinction has become much more blurred. So, no, one does not have to be an atheist to be a humanist, although it's a pretty natural fit.
So, one doesn't have to, we referred to religious humanism, and there was this tradition of religious humanism. It seems to have fallen down some in this country. Actually, it seems to have fallen down some in the world. I mean, is there a religious humanist segment of the American Humanist Association at all, or is that just not part of the game anymore?
I mean, you run the gamut from atheists to agnostics or from atheists to believers.
Right. I think with this group, people are very comfortable wearing a number of tags. Religious humanist is not one of them anymore. Having said that, there are a lot of our members who are members of UU churches, Universalist Unitarian churches. So it's a big tent, and but you really don't find a lot of talk of spirituality at a humanist convention.
So what besides being an atheist makes you... what is the American Humanist Association about? Is it about just the spread of atheism? I mean, why not call it AAA then, the American Atheist Association?
As I said, we have a lot of crossover with atheist groups, but and I don't want to get myself in trouble with those groups who are doing really good work. I like to define humanists as godless do-gooders. Atheists are perhaps just godless, but there's that component of trying. You know, admitting we are animals, we have potential for good and bad, and that, as people said, it's our responsibility. In lieu of a creator, of someone calling the shots and telling us how to act, we better do it well if we want humankind to prosper and continue.
So another American philosopher, actually British philosopher, transplanted to America, Alfred North Whitehead, defined the Unitarian Church. He said it's the church that believes in, at most, one God. So I guess that suggests agnosticism. So
right. But we'll dig into this some more. I want to ask you about that responsibility thing and humans being responsible for making things better, but we'll dig into that. This is a special edition of Philosophy Talk, coming to you from the annual conference of the American Humanist Association in San Jose, California. Our guest is Jennifer Bardi, editor of The Humanist Magazine.
What's so great about humans? If we were ducks, wouldn't we all believe in duckism and take pride in the fact that ducks, by and large, clean up bodies of water rather than pollute them? Isn't humanism just a form of speciesism?
Humanism and its human critics, along with questions from our live audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
Welcome back to Philosophy Talk. We're looking at the movement called humanism. Is humanism only defined by what it doesn't believe in, or is there more to it? I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. And our guest is Jennifer Bardi, editor of The Humanist Magazine.
Does humanism function as your religion? Is it inspiring or depressing to be a humanist? Join the discussion by stepping up to one of the microphones at either side of the stage.
So, Jennifer, look, humanism gives up on religious views like Christianity. But if you give up on that, is humanism really a natural stopping point? I mean, look, in the Judeo-Christian tradition, humans are important because the way God created them and the role he assigned to them. But if that's not the case, if there's no God and he didn't assign us any special role, humans are just another part of evolved nature. Human reason is just a peculiar adaptation carried to great lengths, like say, an elephant's trunk. You know, elephants have really long trunks. Humans have this kind of funny kind of reasoning. If that's so, if we're just evolved animals and not all that special, why place so much emphasis on humans and human reason as opposed to, I don't know, worshiping all of nature in all of its forms? Why have a movement called humanism?
Because we're just so interesting.
You mean we humans?
Humans, oh. Yeah. I mean, we're the only species that could ask that question. And, of course, we study animals to inform ourselves about animal species, but also about ourselves. So I don't think that humanists designate our humans as special, because that I think that implies some designation that comes from elsewhere.
But we're so interesting to ourselves. Now, I mean, if the animal kingdom could talk, they'd say, you guys are completely self-absorbed. Look what you've done to my habitat. Look what you've done to the air I breathe, the water I drink. Look what you've done. There used to be, at the turn of the 20th century, I think I have this right, there were something like 450,000 gorillas in the wild. Now there are 7,000. So if those gorillas could talk, they'd say, you're so interesting. Really? What's so interesting about you?
Well, we'd say, we understand what we've done.
Yeah. But don't you think we'd also be interested in what they had to say?
Say again?
Don't you think if gorillas could speak, we would be equally interested in what they have to say?
Just like the Europeans were really interested in what the Native Americans had to say. Right. Or the Africans had to say. Right, yeah, we would be interested in what they had to say as we said, you know what, okay, you can talk and I'm still going to enslave you. I mean, really, what makes us so interesting? I mean, except to ourselves. From an objective point of view, are we interesting?
Well, but is that a fair starting point? I mean, humanism started in contrast to a religious point of view, mm-hmm. right? I mean, maybe if humanists came together today, they'd call themselves ecologists or something. But I mean, suppose the elephants of the world got together and saw that they were under the influence of a belief system that really devalued trunks. then they might say, well, you know, we need to put an emphasis on trunks. Trunks are just as good as anything else. Mm-hmm. So historically, humanism really isn't so self-absorbed, is it? It's just kind of reacting to the idea that there's something over and above humans.
Yeah, and yeah. I think the idea is that we don't need God. We can screw things up pretty well on our own, and we can also fix them.
Well, there was this one thing that the belief in God, at least a certain kind of God, brought you. Because the universe was guided by a providential God who was benevolent and loving and would see that everything would work out in the end and that all despair had an ultimate redemption. But if you take that guy away and you say, so let's go back to your thing, the responsibilities in our hands for making the world. Because you say, humanism of this sort, practiced by the American Humanist Association, isn't just a negative thing, isn't just a denial that there is a God. It's a positive thing. It says we are responsible. The responsibility is thrown onto us. And I suppose it says it's always been thrown onto us, right? Because the God thought was always a fiction. Mm-hmm. So let's look what the humans have done with this world for which they have always been responsible. And look what they've done with human life for which they've always been responsible. They've created the gulag, the concentration camp, apartheid, ethnic cleansing, the rapacious capitalism that despoils the earth even as we sit here and speak. Mm-hmm. So what do you say in defense of that?
There's baseball and the iPad.
Well, that's true, too. Yeah. What do you say in defense of that?
There's Charlie Parker and jazz and all kinds of stuff. I mean, last night, Bill and I was saying, you know, if you're the type that likes to worry, you're living into the perfect time. I think humanists, I wouldn't say more than other thinkers, but they certainly do realize, they acknowledge what we've done, and there's a social justice component, there's also a social conscience component to humanism, and I think a lot of people hear the message yesterday was, let's stop talking about all these things and start doing something.
There is a species of, I guess it's humanism, to which I sometimes slide into subscribing, which is that Christianity only had one thing right, and that was original sin. Humans are totally screwed up. It's just that there's no one else to blame it on. But maybe we should turn to some more optimistic voices.
I think we should. We remind our listeners, you're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're coming to you from the American Humanist Association in San Jose, California. We'd love to have questions from this live audience. We have a whole lineup of people here. I'm going to move from side to side and get as many of them in as I can. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir. Tell us your name and where you're from, and then give us your question.
Good morning. Bill Dusenberry from Broken Arrow, Oklahoma. My understanding of how societies evolved, they started with religious explanations to explain what they didn't know. Then they moved on to the philosophical explanations, which you gentlemen and our guest from the magazine, Jennifer, and now we're into the scientific. I look at the humanist movement as not a philosophical point of view, but a scientific point of view. I think that everything that humanists say is based on science, not on a philosophy, and I'd like to hear your reaction to that.
What do you think about that, Jennifer? You're the card-carrying editor of the Humanist magazine.
I agree partially. I think it started out as a philosophy. I mean, I think it's sort of hard to say it's one or the other.
I think it's a little harder to weasel out of being a philosopher than Bill suggests, because even if he says everything I believe is science, well, then that's your philosophy, that there's no avenue of truth except philosophy.
And let's enumerate the sciences. Okay, there's physics, there's chemistry, there's biology, there's psychology, there's economics. Maybe this one might have a chance. Now I'm going to ask you a question. What ought I to do? How ought I to live? Right? Is science going to tell me that? What institutions ought we to design to better ameliorate human life? Is that a scientific question? That's a question for humans living in the world, grappling together. Now, I think that anybody says that all we have to do is like turn it over to science. If that's the humanist manifesto, all we have to do is turn it over to science. I think there are a lot of people who have a lot of powerful arguments against that movement. That it all comes down to science. All the experts in the lab coats are going to tell us what to do and how to live. Right, Hitler had his experts in the lab coats, so did Stalin. Right, so I don't think science. Let's take some more questions.
Hi, I'm Leslie Zucker from Mercer Island, Washington. And earlier you brought up the point of moral relativism. I'm curious about what the humanist stand is about the objectivity of morality. Thank you.
Oh, that's a good one. That's a tough one. You got it. Is there an official American Humanist Association line on the? Does the magazine
if I can kind of restate the question, it's clear the humanists think there's not a supernatural God. Mm-hmm. That says human morality ought to be this way. Is there another objective source, or is it just?
That's a tough one. I don't have a yes or no answer. I think that evolutionary psychologists will say that morality has evolved. I mean, the way I like to think of it is, if you had a person on the street asking people who walking by, is it wrong to punish an innocent person? Or maybe even more pointedly, is it wrong to murder an innocent person? I think to the person, they would say, yes, that's wrong. And if you said why, they wouldn't say because God said so or because it's in the Ten Commandments. They would say because it's just wrong. But then you get into issues of guilt and innocence. You know, is it wrong to stone a woman for being a virgin? You know, is it wrong to
punish a virgin?
Right, I'm talking about...
For
not being a virgin, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
We're not hedonists, right? Yeah. But, you know, is it wrong to punish two men for being in love? I mean, these are questions, you know, I don't think there's an objective morality there, but I think humanist morality stands up under those questions.
Well, let me ask Ken a question, because Ken, you know, the truth be known, you're pretty much a humanist.
Yeah.
And you've grappled a lot with this problem of relativity of norms. Can you give the humanists a two-sentence response that they should be using here?
Well, no, this is a tough, deep question. Ever since Nietzsche announced the death of God, and even before, philosophers, not scientists, but philosophers, have tried to figure out if there's an objective ground to morality, and they're on all sides of this debate. This is a tough one. Personally, I believe there isn't an objective ground to morality, but that's all right, because we create moral communities and we bind ourselves to them. But that's a really complicated one. And I do have to say that the people, again, speaking from what humanism denies, the people who are anti-humanists, the religious, they have an answer to why there are moral truths. It's God's commands. Of course, they don't really have an answer to why we should care what God commands. So it's a deep and hard, very hard, one of the hardest questions that human beings grapple with. So there's no easy answer to that one, none whatsoever. But let's go. I'll remind our listeners, you're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're coming to you from the American Humanist Association, the 69th annual American Humanist Association in San Jose, California, in front of a live audience of card-carrying humanists, and we've got more questions from that live audience now.
Hi, I'm Don Behem from Beaverton, Oregon, also known as Dr. Don. I produce and host a cable access TV talk show.
Cool.
And I've pondered this question for years and years and years, ever since the song first came out, a song called Alfie. What's it all about, Alfie? And occasionally I dwell on that. And I even hear the melody in my head from time to time. And I come up with answers, but I'm wondering what your take is. What's it all about, Alfie? Shall I sing it for you?
No. No. What's it all? You want each of our individual answers to what's it all about? I don't know the answer to that. But I'm going to put a challenge to the humanists in the room and to Jennifer. I'm going to put a challenge to you. So the religious guys, they had an answer to that question, a ready-made answer. Mm-hmm. It's about carrying out, being an instrument of the divine will. God has a plan for the universe. He created me as an instrument of his will. And my job, I know what my job is, to be an instrument of the divine will. And somehow that's revealed to me through the Bible and through revelation and through religious experience. But there's an answer. Okay, get rid of God, who has a plan. How do we go about, how do we humanist? Or you humanist, because I'm going to play the radio host.
You're one too, though.
Yeah, but I'm the radio host right now. Right. How do humanists go about addressing that question of what's it all about?
Mm-hmm. I'll give you my personal answer. I think we're here to survive, basically. That's my rationalist answer. My poetic answer would be, we're here to love each other. I don't think it goes beyond that.
Well, since Don asked, all three of us, I'll throw out some ideas here. I mean, I think what's fundamental is what I call caring. And I don't mean caring in the sense of a nurse cares for a person. I mean caring in that something matters to you. It just does. I mean, it matters to me whether I get food or not. So in that sense, my survival or my not having hunger is something that matters, and there's a value there. And so, but a lot of other things matter to me too. It matters to me more whether my children get food than whether I get food, at least until they hit 40, and then
I think grandchildren.
Yeah, my grandchildren. For a lot of people, the survival of a local opera company or a ballet company may mean a lot more to them than the quality of their own life. Then there are certain things that don't seem to matter to us very much. The earth is going to blow itself out and the sun in a couple billion years. It's possible to get very depressed about that, but actually it won't affect most of the things that matter to me. So I think we have to start with what matters to not just individual humans, but individual organisms, but really what for each of us matters to us, and build value out from that rather than down from God. So that's my answer.
That's spoken like a deep and true humanist thought, and part of me deeply endorses it, John. But there's a challenge to that. Some things strike us as worthy of mattering. I mean, the size of your toe, the shape of your toe, could be your overwhelming passion in life. You could go to a podiatrist and say, look, I want my toe to be perfectly shaped. And we see that, and we believe that a life governed by that is somehow distorted. Because having your toe, the shape of your toe matter that much just seems wrong, objectively wrong. So, and if, how do we make good that thought if we're card-carrying secular humanists who don't believe in transcendental narratives and all that sort of stuff. How do we make good that?
Well, if you're a card-carrying humanist, then you ought to take a person's concern, if not about their toe, about their nose or their breasts or their chin. I mean, I never liked my chin. You know, it just can't be negated. Everything has human value.
Well, we don't just have to carry one card either.
Yeah, but. I mean, you get into problems. I mean, the Humanist Manifesto 1 was actually much more optimistic about these things than Humanist Manifesto 2, which was after World War II, when you realize that even atheists like Stalin can cause a lot of trouble, or not very religious guys like Hitler. But still, that's where it all has to begin.
You're referring to the multiplicity of hats that we wear. Something.
Sure, I mean, if you want to carry a card that says you're a member of the toe fetish fetishists group, I mean, why not wear that, carry that as well? But I think we assign meaning to our lives. We're not given it. There's no one handing it down to us. We assign meaning to our lives. And I think for most humanists, it's about human connections.
Do you think there is no need to find some kind of grounding for the meanings that we assign in things beyond ourselves? Religion gave you an objective ground, a purported objective ground. And let's grant that there's problems with it being a legitimate ground. But do you think there's no problem for the humanist of trying to ground the meanings that we assign to our lives in something beyond ourselves?
I mean, one would hope that you would ground it in beyond just your own existence, that you are at least trying to contribute to the overall success of the race and the planet.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing humanism with Jennifer Bardi, editor of The Humanist Magazine.
Attending church, going to funerals, celebrating holidays, these rituals and practices of religion help hold communities together. What, if anything, can humanists offer to fulfill these functions?
We're coming to you from the American Humanist Association Conference in San Jose, California. Humanist rituals and the meaning of life, plus more questions from our live audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
Welcome back to the program. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything
except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. We're at the American Humanist Association Conference in San Jose, California. Our guest is Jennifer Bardi, editor of The Humanist Magazine. We've got a whole lineup of questioners here. Let's try to get through a few more of them before.
Absolutely.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Hello. My name is Peter Bishop. I am webmaster and humanist philosopher for the International Federation of Secular and Humanistic Judaism. And although we are at a national conference of the American Humanist Association, I don't know if you're aware that there are representatives from the Society for Humanistic Judaism here. I'm here from the International Federation of Secular and Humanistic Judaism. In addition, there are representatives of ethical culture here. Now, both ethical culture and the Society for Humanistic Judaism are parallel to the American Humanist Association, but those two organizations are generally considered to represent religious humanism. Now, the religious humanism that they represent is a religious naturalistic humanism. It's the same kind of humanism that you've been talking about.
Well, let me ask you a question. One thing about Jews is they have a lot of cool rituals, starting with the bris. I don't know how cool that is for the brissy, but it does bring everybody else together. There's Yom Kippur. There's all sorts of things. Most of these, though, are oriented around religion and religious history and a self-conception of the Jews as a chosen people with a special connection to God. How does this ritual live on when you become naturalized humanists?
Right. This is largely taken care of, partly in conjunction with the International Institute for Secular Humanistic Judaism, which is ordaining rabbis in both the United States and Israel and has been for several years. So a humanistic Jewish congregation, which is recognized by, for example, the American Federation of Jewish Organizations, when you go and you attend one of these services, it looks just like a normal synagogue. So the Birmingham Temple in Farmington Hills, Michigan, which was Rabbi Sherwin Wein's humanist Jewish temple, it looks just like a normal Jewish synagogue.
But I want to press this a little bit more, and Jennifer, I want your thought about this too, but I understand the impulse to religious humanism. I understand it deeply, and I understand that because one of the things that kind of atheistic humanism lacks is the rituals of human life, the transitions in human life, the coming of age rituals, the passing of the marriage rituals, and those things enable people to narrate their lives, and it gives a grand part of a grand scheme, and that's really cool. But this desire to have the rituals without the sort of metaphysics. Isn't that trying to have your cake and eat it too? I mean, isn't it kind of like, you know, okay, we don't believe in any of the things that these rituals are based on, really, but we want the rituals, so we just give themselves. Isn't that kind of insincere? And
No, it's not. Because in humanistic Judaism, for example, they have carefully mapped it out and shown its relationship to the Judaism of the past, Spinoza, Einstein. It turns out that the rabbinic tradition leads to free thought. It led to the first organized humanist organization in the United States, Ethical Culture, established in 1876.
So look, I agree that a lot of the ideas in humanism do come out of Jewish thought and Jewish thinking. But still, Jewish ritual pretty much historically depends on the idea as Jewish people as chosen by God. But if there's no God to do the choosing, doesn't that undermine the basis of the ritual?
I'm going to let Jennifer in here.
I'm going to assume that humanistic Jews would say that they have constructed these rituals and that it doesn't come from the Word of God, but that they're still very valuable and important. So I think in that regard, it's not insincere. I would say that there are a lot of humanists who reject ritual. They're very anti-authoritarian, and they see that as just one more structure that they don't want imposed upon their life. It's a big ten, as I said, and so we have these various ways to fulfill that.
It is a natural problem. I mean, I was raised as a Christian, and Christian hymns are still kind of can move me to tears, Amazing Grace and stuff like that. But Amazing Grace is God's giving your mind authority over your body, which he took away from human beings because Adam made him angry. I mean, grace makes no sense, and yet Amazing Grace is a great song. How do you preserve what you like without, as Ken says, metaphysics?
You know, just pick and choose, I guess. But let's get some more questions here in this side of the room. Welcome.
My name is Stephanie Hughes, and I'm from Naperville, Illinois, humanist west of Chicago. We have been living in a cultures where dominance and domineering has been the mode of existence. We humanists, as I see it, are trying to use the human experience itself, reason, study, and compassion to get to a different place where we have true justice. We're trying to go beyond just surviving to letting everyone thrive. We're trying to nurture everyone. And so some of us have the platinum rule, which is try to meet the needs of everyone and do that by negotiating in win-win-win ways to meet the needs of everyone.
I think that's a laudable and admirable goal. I'm going to just be a little pessimistic. Because you talk about human reason and human sentiment. These are the two things we have going for us. Compassion, you know, with fellow feeling, and reason. And here's the thing that is undeniable if you look at the long sweep of human history. Compassion runs out when it comes up against self-interest and national agendas and all that sort of stuff. The Europeans, you know, and during the Age of the Enlightenment, that's when they conquered the world and subjective native peoples. Human reason, that's a great thing, but do you really trust the deliverances of human reason to always track the good, the true, the right?
You're kind of a pessimistic humanist.
Pessimistic humanist. So, I mean, I just think the thing I said at the beginning, that was a pretense. Rah-rah for humanism? Mm-hmm. Say two rahs for humanism, but then there's this thing you have to be on guard about the limits of human compassion and the limits of human reason. I just think you have to be on guard.
But deep in your soul, don't you have some compassion for British Petroleum?
Jennifer, you wanted to make a comment.
Well, I was going
to
say, I mean, but is human compassion so much better brought out in religion?
No, I wasn't defending religion. I was saying in our, you know, that decline of optimism from the first manifesto to the second, mm-hmm. that was for good reason, because it turned out the 20th century revealed something to us about the workings of scientific rationality. There have been three major scientific states in the 20th century. There was the Western European scientific establishment, there was Nazi Germany, that was a scientific establishment, and there was the Communist Soviet Union, right? And two of them were instruments of utter darkness, utter moral darkness. So I don't think you can just say scientific rationality, ray.
You think the lesson of the 20th century was it wasn't all God's fault.
Yeah, exactly. But why don't we take another question on this side of the room?
Yeah, good morning. My name is Dr. Rudy Garrity. I lead an organization known as the American Learnership Forum. We take a little bit of a different view on this conversation, is that the human beings are the only species that really can develop self-awareness. And that since we have been developing self-awareness for an awful long time right now, I think there was a break point somewhere around the Enlightenment when we started to understand concepts like progress could really be managed by the human beings who are doing learning and lifelong development. My suggestion is that from a theory to practice point of view is if we focus on human beings in social formats seeking personal self-fulfillment, organizational high performance, and community common good, working on those foundations and the practices that help that happen helps the whole societal grow, then you can define to what degree all of our other points of view fit into that landscape, and humanism becomes simply a self-awareness thing that I've discovered myself through the process. What do you think about that?
I'm not quite sure I understand it in total.
Well, it's the idea that it's not being human, it's being self-aware, and self-awareness has been a traditional a non-theological source for an ethical point of view. What's good is what promotes, enhances, and self-awareness, and it's an interesting but definitely philosophical point of view.
And I mean, there is something that I think is deep about that fact that human beings are self-aware. We are the only animals, it turns out, that represent to themselves at every moment after you stop being a baby, where you are in a total lifespan. That is, human beings represent themselves as I'm young and I'm going to get older, I'm middle-aged, I've been younger, I'm going to get older, I'm old, and most of my life is behind me. And we have this unfolding narrative of our lives, always, at every moment. And because of that, because we anticipate the future as a future for us and remember the past, we have this problem. What am I to be? What have I been? How do I narrate myself? This comes with the turf of being human. And that's really important because that gives rise to all these things that we use to narrate our lives, all this ritual and stories and myth and everything. We give ourselves this stuff because we've got this problem. And there's no escaping it. It's a deep fact of human life. So I don't...
Well, that is a deep fact of human life, and it comes from being reasoning and being self-aware. But ultimately, from an evolutionary natural point of view, those are just oddities of the human.
That's true.
Human life. I mean, maybe whales basically lead a happier life. They got big brains. They must be conscious of a lot of stuff we're not conscious of. They sing to each other across the oceans. So they don't know that they're getting old. Yeah. Big deal.
Yeah. Well, so, I mean, that's why there are special problems of living a human life that humanism, you know, addresses. But yeah, let's
Well, I wanted to just say that I think there's also the very stark difference between having the luxury to have a certain standard of living where these are pressing ideas that you have time to devote to. You know, some people, their lives are such that they just...
Yeah, that's true, but you know, that shows something deep about the problem with human life. Sometimes people can give you the narrative. They can say, you are my worker, you are my slave, you are my appendage, and I think within all of us is the ability, and this is what I celebrate in humanism, they're within all of us in the ability to say, no, I own my life, not you, even if we have to exercise that against the grain sometimes.
But Jennifer is indicating an important idea, this theory of the leisure class, right? That it's only when we have more than we need to get by that we can do philosophy and become truly depressed about the nature of existence, right?
Okay, I want to take one last questioner from our live audience.
Hi, my name is Amanda Kniff. I'm from Des Moines, Iowa, and I'm a humanist celebrant, and you were talking about ritual earlier. And humanists celebrate the fact that we have one life, and it is something to be treasured. And so we take these rituals in life very seriously. And although we don't put any religious connotation into them, people do take birth and marriage and death and every step in between very seriously, and it's something that, that we enjoy and we do mark, and we just don't take any religious aspect of it.
Do you just take over rituals from old archaic religious orders, or have you invented your own new rituals that are grounded in humanist beliefs?
I think there are some wonderful traditions in religion that we have modified, and there are some new ones that we've done, and I think that we've improved a lot of them so that they make people appreciate parts of their life more.
What's an improved ritual?
I think when someone is in hospice and they're coming to the end of their life, rather than trying to figure out, you know, what's happened in their life, we just listen and let them tell us about their life or what they're feeling, rather than trying to convert them.
Well, that really sounds moving. That sounds like a great ritual. So, Jennifer, I'll give you a chance for one last comment on whatever you want to comment on.
I've been wanting to say something about humanism. I'd like humanists to embrace their revolutionary spirit a little bit more. I think we try so hard to adapt and gain acceptance and respect, and I think we have to acknowledge that American humanists are revolutionary. We come from a revolutionary spirit, and when the talk show hosts you were mentioning earlier...
Glenn Beck.
Help me out, O'Reilly.
Yeah,
and Glenn
yeah,
Beck.
Those guys.
And they,
yeah.
They
you suppress their names. Good for you.
they're under attack from us, mm-hmm. apparently, and I think that we need to reinforce the idea again and again that we are trying to preserve the philosophies and the values and the language of our Constitution, and that you know we can do that through love and through our energy, and whether we adopt religious rituals or not, that's our main goal.
On that call to the barricades, I'm going to thank you for joining us. It's been an interesting conversation.
Thank you so much.
Our guest has been Jennifer Bardi, editor of the Humanist magazine.
And we also want to thank our live audience. Thanks for those of you who asked questions, and thanks to everyone who was here. Give yourselves a round of applause.
So, John, you got some closing thoughts here. What's on your mind right now?
Well, what's on my mind right now is how many of the questioners were from my neck of the woods, the Great Plains, the Midwest, what are now often called the red states and thought to be just hopeless habitats for really out-of-date thinking. But that's not true. I mean, the Great Plains have always been a great breeding ground for free thinkers and humanists and atheists, and I was... thrilled the young man from Broken Arrow, Oklahoma. I spent a good deal of time when I was young in Broken Bow, Nebraska, and I never realized there was a Broken Arrow, Oklahoma. And I'm going to go right home and go to the internet and see if somehow Broken Bow and Broken Arrow have a connection in the past.
So look, my closing thought about this is I am a card-carrying humanist, but I guess I am a pessimist, a humanist of a kind of pessimistic variety, because I'm not sure the worship of human reason that's implicit in some forms of humanism, and the worship of human compassion, because I am struck by looking at the history of humanity at the limits of those things, at how often they have failed us, how often they have fallen short, and at the nightmares they have led us into. So I don't want to end on a pessimistic note, but, you know, there is a note of pessimism there. But this conversation continues, as always, on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is cogito ergo blogo, I think, therefore I blog.
And you can download podcasts of our program from our website. For the final word today, however, we're going to turn to the fastest hope for human progress, Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, look what humanism is up against. Centuries of religious fervor fueled by martyrdom, saints, vast galleries of angels and demons, temptation, sin, redemption, clever arguments proving the existence of God, wars fought around lines of succession, popes, visionaries, mystics, crusades, existential crises of faith, the threat of eternal damnation, the promise of eternal salvation, the rapture, gospel music, hymns, churches, congregations, pancake dinners, prayer breakfasts, after-service coffee in a church basement, potluck dinners with green jello and shredded carrots, snake handling, shunning, excommunication, baptismal rites, last rites, and Stephen Baldwin. What does humanism offer in return? Evolution. That doesn't seem to be working out too well right now. And if you go to a humanist museum, if there is such a thing, I suspect you won't have an exhibit featuring a robot Jesus riding a triceratops. What kind of museum is that? How, in short, do you identify yourself as a humanist with the same kind of pizzazz that a priest's garment confers, or a flaming sword, or a simple cross on the lapel? You can put a Darwin fish on your bumper, I suppose. It's not exactly the same thing as speaking in tongues. Now, some have compiled lists of humanist heroes, folks like Voltaire, Thomas Paine, Isaac Asimov, and Carl Sagan. That's all to the good, but none of them hold a candle to Joan of Arc, say, who led an army and perished in flames. Did Darwin lead an army? No, he sat at home writing. More than a century after his death, he stands accused of being the shrewd mastermind behind secular humanism, Nazism, communism, eugenics, and predatory capitalism. That's pretty good for a guy who spent his final days observing the behavior of earthworms. Certainly, humanism can't hope to compete with the Alamo, Hundred Years' War, or Fox's Book of Martyrs. The most humanism can manage is to be on the wrong side of the culture wars. Pornography, cursing, blaspheming, the decline of polite discourse, video games, violence in the media, and women holding jobs, all related at the feet of secular humanists who apparently meet in darkened rooms on a regular basis without even the benefit of secret handshakes or arcane rituals. Why not a secret handshake, humanists? Why not robes emblazoned with a blazing red H, perhaps? Why not secret rituals? At the very least, why not a calendar with famous humanists like Alfred North Whitehead or, I don't know, Garrison Keillor, nude? Why not bubblegum cards, bobblehead dolls, maybe rewrite the Humanist Manifesto with a torrid sex scene or two? Because here's the deal, humanism is boring. You won't find swarms of humanists shouting the humanist credo, I believe in the perfectibility of man, to the barricades. On second thought, everything you need to know about humanism can probably get from reruns of Star Trek. Just don't reissue the Humanist Manifesto in Klingon. Word to the wise. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2010.
Our executive producer is David Demarest. Special thanks to Clayton Witt.
Thanks also to Dan Brandon, Rena Palta, Merle Kessler, and Corey Goldman.
Our production coordinator is Devin Strolovich. Daniel Elstein and Ben Hirsch are our directors of research. Lael Weiss is our webmaster.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from the Stanford Humanities Center, various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk,
and from the members of KALW Local Public Radio, San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
Henry Ford Community College has a medical practice clinical management degree program that will prepare you for a rewarding career in the exciting field of healthcare. You can earn a certificate as a medical office assistant or a two-year degree in medical office management. For more information, give us a call at 800-585-HFCC.
Think you have what it takes? We do. Henry Ford Community College. Visit us online at hfcc.edu.
HFCC's Associate Degree Program in Automotive Technology includes detailed instruction related to the various systems found on today's vehicles. This program is designed to provide students with a thorough knowledge of the technical aspects of the automobile and to develop a certain level of manual skill in servicing, testing, and diagnosing. Classroom and laboratory classes provide students with the experience and understanding they'll need to qualify in numerous fields of employment associated with the automobile industry. For more information on HFCC's Associate Degree Program in Automotive Technology, contact Instructor Gary Hines at 313-845-6350. That's Instructor Gary Hines at 313-845-6350.
Think you have what it takes? We do. Henry Ford Community College. Visit us online at hfcc.edu.
I'm trying to use the phone!
Hey, loyal listener. Call WHFR at 313-845-9676 or toll free at 1-800-585-HFCC, extension 9676.
What? I couldn't hear that last part.
That's 845-9676 or toll free 1-800-585-HFCC, extension 9676.
Hi, this is Peter Sagal, host of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. What do you get when you take a bunch of public radio nerds and shut them in a room with computer geeks? Well, in addition to some bizarrely socially awkward offspring, you get the Public Radio Player. It's a new iPhone app that streams hundreds of public radio stations, including this one, straight to your iPhone and iPod Touch. You can get more information at publicradioplayer.org.
WebAdvisor, a program allowing students and staff access to college-related information. Through WebAdvisor, you are able to register for classes, view grades, track financial aid, print class schedules, and much more. Log into WebAdvisor by going to my.hfcc.edu/webadvisor or from the homepage, hfcc.edu.
Are you looking for a real degree that's going to prepare you for the future? Then listen up. The Alternative Energy Technology degree is great for students looking to prepare themselves for a career in a new generation of green jobs. Students will learn about renewable energy and promoting and practicing of energy efficiency. If you're interested in more information about this degree or any of the other degrees here at HFCC, please call 1-800-585-HFCC or visit them online at www.hfcc.edu.
The Trade and Apprentice Education Division of the Henry Ford Community College is excited to present a new 10-credit hour renewable energy certificate program. The content of the courses will be structured to inform the students of both present and future renewable energy concepts. This certificate program should interest students who are looking for an alternative to our current reliance on fossil fuels. To learn more about this program, please contact the Trade and Apprentice Education Division at 313-845-9609 or on the internet at www.hfcc.edu.
The WHFR Monday Forum, an hour of a wide variety of one or more talk show programs from 6 to 7 p.m., some of which are locally produced.
Today turns into yesterday, leaving only words we say for this time.
New ideas and information, different each week, not available on other Detroit stations. That's why we're the station making waves. WHFR.FM. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to WHFR at hfcc.edu.
The good times, the hard times. This time is our time.
The WHFR Monday Forum, 6 to 7 p.m. And also listen to all locally produced talk shows on WHFR Tuesday Forum from 1 to 2 p.m.
Hello, everyone. My name is Omni646, and I'm your driver for the Rhythmic Ride. We will be traveling along the sonic spectrum of urban music every Saturday from 10 p.m. to midnight. Rap, R&B, jazz, hip-hop, pop, and any other urban music by local and independent artists will be featured. Be sure to tune in on Saturdays from 10 to midnight on the only station making waves, 89.3 WHFR.FM.
Hi, Olympic gold medalist and professional beach volleyball player Misty May Trainor here with Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck, reminding you to get moving every day.
Because when you get moving an hour a day,
you'll have more energy to dig into the things you like to do. Kick the soccer ball around,
ride your bike,
or dance in your room.
Get up and play an hour a day, Doc. Check out how to be a player.
Head online to get tips on great ways to get moving every day
at www.letsmove.gov. A message from the Ad Council and HHS.
Hi, this is Pat Frisco from the Spirits Rejoice radio program with another thought to consider. The creative artist has always worked outside the box. The truly creative artist has a unique perspective, a unique voice. Their works of art go beyond what a painting is supposed to look like, or a jazz or classical piece is supposed to sound like. As a result, these artists are often overlooked, underpaid, or totally neglected. Just look across the radio dial. But these artists always have a home at WHFR. You can tune into Spirits Rejoice Tuesdays from 6 to 10 p.m. or many of our other fine radio programs here at 89.3 WHFR Dearborn.
To be a good father is the most important job in a man's life. But it doesn't have to be hard. Play catch. Go to a park or visit a zoo. Help your child with their homework. Sit down together for dinner. Ask them how their day was. Things get busy, and sometimes we all fall short. But the smallest moments can have the biggest impact on a child's life. Take time to be a dad today.
Learn more at 1-877-4DAD-411 or visit fatherhood.gov.
Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Every day, you can help good things happen. Claudia, a local health worker in Nicaragua, helps save 6 children from pneumonia. Rosina in Bangladesh helps save 10 children from diarrhea. Aster in Ethiopia helps save 20 from malaria. And Salif in Mali helps save 30 from the effects of malnutrition. Help one, save many. Visit goodgoes.org to find all the ways you can help the good go further. Brought to you by Save the Children and the Ad Council.
WHFR Dearborn.
We would love to talk to you. Give me a call, 313-845-9842. That's 313-845-9842.
Is your mind wandering? Is it maybe a little hard to focus today? Or is the person in the next cube yapping on a cell phone or maybe whistling mindlessly to some song? Only he or she can hear, of course. Well, these are all pretty good reasons to put those headphones on for a little while and just get lost in the music. Music. It makes you work so much more efficiently. And if the boss happens to raise an eyebrow at those headphones, well, just explain that music, especially wordless music with melodious sounds like, say, classical music, helps to encourage the release of dopamine. And that extra boost will help you focus on what you're doing. That's the latest research coming from the Mayo Clinic, anyway. We'll get to hear the melodious sounds of Haydn coming up later in the hour. It's a Haydn symphony coming up a little later in the hour. And to start things off this hour, here's the last movement from a pastoral symphony written by François Gossec.
Thank you.